This is the Siecla, episode 16, Romantique. Welcome back. This week, we're stepping away from our narrative to look at a cultural development in Restoration France, the burgeoning Romanticism movement in literature. This takes the form of an interview with Professor Philippe Moisan, my undergrad French professor. Interestingly, while this is episode 16 of the Siecla, it's in some ways the very first episode of the show. I recorded this interview way back in May of 2018, after about 5 months of research into the show, but still 6 months before I announced it publicly, and 8 months before episode 1 was released. I happened to be back on campus and arranged to meet Professor Moisan for an interview. I've sat on it ever since, waiting for the right moment, which I feel has now arrived, as our narrative reaches the 1820s, and figures such as Chateaubriand and Victor Hugo have entered the scene. This interview is a casual conversation, in which both Moisan and I drop various references to historical figures and terms, without always explaining them. If you're ever confused, be sure to check out the transcript at thesiecla.com/episode16, to which I've added hyperlinks and footnotes to help explain anything uncertain. That's thesiecla.com. Unlike most episodes of The Siecla, this interview requires fairly minimal background knowledge to comprehend, so if you like it, feel free to share it with your friends. If this is your first time listening to the show, then I'd encourage you to subscribe after this episode, and then go back to begin with episode 1, which introduces France in 1814, in the immediate aftermath of Napoleon's downfall. I'm so excited to share this with you, as it's one of the favorite interviews I've ever conducted, chock full of fascinating insights and commentary about history, literary analysis, and more. I hope you like it as much as I do. For today's episode, we're going to be looking at the French literature of the early 19th century. Now, I'll be honest, this is not my area of expertise. So I've brought on a guest who is an expert in this, Philippe Moisan, a professor of French at my alma mater, Grinnell College in Iowa. Moisan is a native of Brittany, with degrees from the Université de Caen and Washington University in St. Louis, who has published works on Victor Hugo, Chateaubriand, and Émile Zola, among other French authors. Professor Moisan, bienvenue.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't we start off with the big picture? What are the major trends and changes in French literature during the Restoration and this period in early 19th century France?
Well, the main literary movement, of course, is Romanticism, which starts later than in other countries in France. It really starts with the publication of Les Méditations Poétiques, Poetical Meditations by Lamartine, published in 1820. So Romanticism is going to dominate most of the period of the Restoration, which doesn't mean that it's doesn't go without any problems of resistance from what would people call les anciens, the people who were defending the tradition, literary tradition. But it's mainly the main movement, Romanticism, yes.
Romanticism has started earlier in Germany and in other places.
Well, like you said, you're not a specialist in a Restoration. I'm not a specialist of German and English literature, but it started very early in Germany with Goethe, with Werther. I know the title in French, Souffrance du jeune Werther, Suffering of the Young Werther, or something like this. I think as early as 1775, something like this. And of course, in England in the early 19th century with Byron, Shelley, it was predominant way before France, mainly because, well, the young readers were busy with the Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. So this is why it mainly started after the Revolution era. Although there were authors like Chateaubriand who announced Romanticism, but it really started officially as a literary movement in the early 20s in France.
Is it fair to talk about Romanticism as a single movement covering all of French literature at this point, or are there significant currents within this that are maybe unfair to lump together into one category?
Well, there were other older writers, but they are not read anymore. So there are very few that we remember. Maybe the only one who is like the link between the old generation and the new generation is Chateaubriand, who is in many aspects someone from the 18th century. He started to write in the late 18th century. And he is very, very popular at the beginning of the 19th century. And he has a strange position because he's admired by Victor Hugo. Victor Hugo, when he's very young, has this sentence, "What do you want?" When people ask him what he wants to be, he says, "I want to be Chateaubriand or nothing." Lamartine would use to walk to Chateaubriand's house and would climb on a tree and observe Chateaubriand leaving his house in his garden and so on. So he was admired. So he's the link between the old generation and the new generation. There's also Benjamin Constant. So there are older writers, but basically it's the years where the new generation is rising slowly but surely.
You've mentioned a couple names so far. Why don't you go through some of the major figures in the French literary movement in this period from sort of 1815 on into the 1830s and 40s? Who are the big names that people should know about?
Well, once again, Chateaubriand is still very important, but I would say the two most important names, at least for the Restoration period, is first of all Lamartine, who is very important in poetry. He starts with Méditation poétique and poems like The Lac, The Lake. He really starts the Romanticism in France. The second very important writer is, of course, Victor Hugo, who is going to be the main representative of this new genre, this new movement, Romanticism. And around Victor Hugo, there's a galaxy of several authors, like De Vigny, Musset a little bit later. So they have salons, it's called a cénacle, and they talk about literature. But the main characters, people, Lamartine and Victor Hugo. Lamartine is more about poetry. Victor Hugo is also a poet, but he's also one which was one of the main genre, literary genre. Then he writes plays. So theater is where you need to gain power to achieve what you want.
So talk about what characterized French Romanticism as a genre, as a movement, and what made it distinct from what came before and what came after. What are the unique characteristics of French Romanticism?
Well, it's a complicated and complex system of ideas, so I will try to be simple. Basically, what is before Romanticism is Classicism, and to characterize Classicism is basically in Classicism you need to respect a set of rules. And in Romanticism, you more transgress this rule. So you judge the quality in Classicism. You judge the quality of a work, of a play, of a poem, if this play, this poem, respect the rules of the ancients, basically. In Romanticism, this is why this is the revolution. This is a literary revolution. You create everything. You break the old rules. Whether it is in theater in France, for example, in Classicism, you have this règle des trois unités, which is like the rules that you have. The play needs to take place in one day, in one location, and one action, basically. Victor Hugo is going to do is to break these rules. For example, one of these play, the most important play, I would say, in the romantic era is Hernani, which takes place in several locations over the course of several years or several months at least. So it's breaking the rules. I would say that the easy way to to characterize the difference between classicism and romanticism is, at least in France, in the one of the main tension in the in plays, in novels, is the relationship to the father, basically. And globally, I would say that in a classic play, it's usually the father who kills the son. And in Romanticism, it's about the son who is going to kill the father.
You talked about how Romanticism got a little bit of a late start in France. Mm-hmm. How long does it last? At what point can you say that Romanticism has faded and something new has taken its place?
Once again, it's difficult to... Well, there are dates that people know, but it's difficult to point out exactly. There's no 31st of December of January 1st in a cultural movement, as you know. So it's difficult to pinpoint exactly. But there are dates that are important. I would say several phases that we can identify. There is, first of all, the 20s, 1820s, when you're a 19th century specialist, the 20s is the 1820s. I would say the 20s is basically the build-up, the installation of Romanticism as a literary movement. So there's a lot of resistance from the les anciens, the ancients, the traditionalists, and the new generation. So I would say this is the build-up of this literary movement, the 20s. Then after Hernani, it's clear that Romanticism is installed as a cultural movement, not only in literature, by the way, also in painting, with Delacroix, La Liberté du Peuple is a painting from 1830, and also, for example, in music with Chopin, for example. So it's a global movement. So from the 30s are going to be the years where Romanticism is dominant and dominates everything. Everybody, if you are 20 and older, you are romantic. Okay, then it starts to fade away at the beginning of the 40s. Like usually, when there's a new generation, they're going to contest the power of the older generation. And I think the last... So there's a slow decline throughout the 40s. And I think we can identify the end of Romanticism in literature with Flaubert and Madame Bovary, who one of the main themes of Madame Bovary is to make fun of Romanticism.
So a figure like Victor Hugo wrote well beyond this period you're talking about.
Yeah.
Did he change with the changing currents, or did he continue to write in the same style with his later works that he was in his early works?
Well, it's a little bit of both, I would say. And it's true that Victor Hugo is unique in that sense, because it doesn't exactly follow the breakdown of literary movements. If you have a novel like Les Misérables, for example, which was published in 1862, so a few years, 5-6 years after Madame Bovary, which is the first modern novel, Victor Hugo in many ways write Les Misérables as if he was in the 30s, like a historical type of historical novels like Alexandre Dumas writes, for example. So he's a little bit, in some ways, anachronic in that way. But at the same time, whether it is about the themes, the where it takes place, Les Misérables is very much a modern novel too, because it talks a lot about the situation, the political, cultural situation of the 19th century.
This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
We want to tell you guys a little bit about our podcast. Tom and I met in college, became best friends, and then teachers almost 20 years ago. Sometimes school just does not allow us to elaborate on the topics that we find interesting, like the real shark attacks that inspired the movie Jaws, or the real historical context to Indiana Jones artifacts. Where does cereal come from? Or are zombies real? Does Ben Franklin really deserve to be on a $100 bill? On our podcast, just like in our class, there are no stupid questions.
Just two friends having a lighthearted conversation about history, pop culture, and the context of current events.
Listen to History Teachers Talking Podcast from Evergreen Network, anywhere you get your podcasts.
You talked about how Romanticism had a difference in theme and emphasis and style from the earlier classic works. Were there different differences in the use of language? Was the writing style itself changing beyond the bigger picture?
Yes, completely. In Classicism, if you count the kind of words that are used, there are very few words used in Classicism. I think around 1,000. I don't exactly remember. One of the revolutions of Victor Hugo is to introduce words that were not used at all in theater. So a set of words. Victor Hugo said, "J'ai mis un bonnet rouge au dictionnaire français." So he revolutionized the French language in literature at that period.
It's not the case that he was inventing words, but he was bringing words in that weren't seen as acceptable in literature.
Exactly. They were words that you couldn't use in a French play or in a poem, for example. And Victor Hugo introduced all kinds of words that were unknown before. It's part of his theory that he develops in one of these essays, La Préface de Cromwell, Cromwell Preface. Cromwell was on one of these plays, where he developed the idea of the concept, literary concept of harmonie des contraires, harmony of the contrary, where the sublime and the grotesque need to be mixed together, and it creates something new, something beautiful. You see that in the use of the words. And you can see that in some ways in Les Misérables, a novel that everybody knows, where you could have the grotesque of Thénardier, for example, and the sublime of the love between Marius and Cosette.
So let's connect these literary trends to the political and economic situation that is happening at this time. Obviously, France is just come off incredibly chaotic and violent years of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. There's a conservative order that's ascendant politically, but the bourgeoisie has a lot more rights and influence and money than they used to have. And France is also about to undergo an industrial revolution. How is French literature engaging with these changes in French society and in politics?
Well, I would say that maybe it's not during the Restoration that you see the influence of politics in literature, but more after, with Balzac, for example, which most of these novels, or many of them, take place during the Restoration. So you can see this cultural economic movement shift in Balzac's literature, where the bourgeoisie is rising, where you cannot exist in Balzac's novel. You cannot exist as a character if you don't have any money. If you don't know how to gain money, have a job, you don't exist as a character. When, for example, in Chateaubriand, there's a famous novel called Atala. It's a love story, and to keep it short, at one moment, the two main characters, Chactas and Atala, are wandering in the American wilderness, which is described as a Garden of Eden. But at no point they have food problem. They have a problem with food, money. They can exist without the reality. I think the shift, and you see that its character exists in a society dominated by the bourgeoisie, is like you need to have money, you need to have a house, and all these materialistic details to function as a character.
It's interesting talking about the relationship of these writers to French politics, given that many of these writers at one point or another became heavily involved in French mm-hmm. politics. Mm-hmm. Chateaubriand was a major restoration figure, Lamartine mm-hmm. was major in the Second Republic. Mm-hmm. Victor Hugo was a prominent critic of Napoleon III. Mm-hmm. Was there something unique about the stature of French literature that made these this overlap between letters and politics so prominent?
I don't know how far you can go, but there's a tradition of what we now call in French intellectuel, public figures who have written books, who have a voice in the public sphere, public political sphere. It of course started with the 18th century, with Diderot, Voltaire, Rousseau, were intellectual and have a discourse about the way the society should be run. So in many ways, Victor Hugo, Lamartine, and Chateaubriand continue this tradition in the 19th century. But the term intellectuel will arrive with the Dreyfus affair with Zola, when Zola will have a real political influence because of his status, because he wrote books, basically. People are going to listen to him, but because Zola didn't have any political role, he was not elected in any shape or form, but he had his power, intellectual power, because he wrote novels. So they continue, they are part of this French tradition, I would say.
Some of the figures you mentioned, perhaps most notably Chateaubriand, and then also a number of other figures, were also heavily involved in writing nonfiction at this time. Do you see that as a distinct, very something distinct from the literary changes in Romanticism, or was the changes in the nonfiction, both Chateaubriand's works on Christianity and other topics, the various histories of the French Revolution that were written during this time by Guizot and Thiers, is that part of the Romantic movement as well, or is that something different?
Well, I think it's it's a complicated issue and very complex to deal with, but I would say it's important to understand that the what we could call the hierarchy between genres is completely different until the Restoration and after the Restoration. To put it very simply, I would say that if you want to be, if you are young, usually these are men. It's another question, but most of prominent writers are male. If you are a young man in the 1820s, the main genre is poetry and theater. And novels novel as a genre doesn't exist or is at the periphery of literature. It's going to change completely with Balzac. Balzac is going to, in many ways, invent the modern novel, and the genre is going to be, if you want to achieve something, you need to write novels, an important novel. So I don't know if it's answering your question, but it's more, I would say, fluid before Balzac, and less, I would say, after.
You mentioned, of course, that most of these writers are male. Mm-hmm. What can you say about the degree of diversity that there was here? Were these all men from a fairly narrow socioeconomic class, or were there a diversity of perspectives? I know there were a handful of female authors at the time. French literacy was still not universal at this point. How diverse was the population of French authors and readers at this time?
It's interesting about the Romanticism, because many of the Romantic writers come from the aristocracy. Alfred de Musset, de Vigny, Lamartine were all member of the aristocracy. So there's a paradox because the young members, some young members of this dying class, aristocracy, were representing this new literary genre, at least at the beginning of Romanticism in France. But I would say most of them would come from the bourgeoisie. So the working class doesn't exist yet. The people who live in the country, they could read, but to be a writer, you need a library at home, this kind of thing. So it's very much either a member of the aristocratic elite or a member young bourgeois. There are extremely few women. George Sand is probably the most famous one, but she's the exception. She had, because of her family, was very open-minded. She had access to a library, and so it's completely different. She's unique.
Is there one author or work that you think really encapsulates the spirit of the times of Romanticism in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s in France?
Once again, these are difficult questions, but I would say I don't know where to start. I would give several. Someone we didn't talk about it, which is a novel actually, "The Red and the Black" by Stendhal and "Le Rouge et le Noir," which describes the trajectory of a young man, Julien Sorel, and the novel takes place most in during the Restoration, during Romanticism. So Julien Sorel is in many ways the archetype of a Romantic hero. So to understand how a Romantic hero or character functions, I think Julien Sorel would be a good character.
So talk a little bit more about the Red and the Black and this character and why he's such an archetypical example of the Romantic period.
Well, first of all, Julien Sorel exists in a society that is pretty much still dominated by the old classes, aristocracy and the clergy. He's also a young man in his 20s who exists after the Napoleonic era. So Julien Sorel feels that he cannot be a Napoleonic hero. The war is over. And the only way he can survive is to play with the system. This is one aspect that is important. The second aspect is also the importance of love. Love and the expression of the self, happiness is an essential part of Julien Sorel's, the way he functions.
You've written about the idea of this period marking, quote, the end of humanism and the birth of modernity. Well, what do you mean by that?
What is important during this period, I would say the Restoration, and actually another novel that we can use to see this very well is the Les Misérables, which is a novel which was published in 1862, but the action is mainly during the Restoration. It starts, the real action starts in 1815 and it stops in 1833-34. So it's about the Restoration, and what you see during this period is that basically the end of the Enlightenment. People have the Enlightenment, have read the French philosopher of the 18th century, and they are still using them. And there are many characters in Les Misérables who are the 18th century as a foundation, intellectual foundation, but one of the ideas of Les Misérables, what you can see in Les Misérables, the tools created by the 18th century philosophers are not working because the society is completely different. The 18th century intellectuals were talking about a world that was essentially rural. The 19th century is more and more urban. So the social problems that you have in the 18th century are completely different from the problems that you have in the 19th century. So you can see this in Les Misérables. This is what I'm talking about, actually. The end of humanism is basically the end of the way you see and you can analyze the world in the beginning of the 19th century. Then you have the creation of new tools. We talk about pre-Romanticism, we can talk about pre-Marxism. You're going to start to use or to invent tools that will be able to solve or try to solve the problems of the 19th century. So this is this period. Once again, it's difficult to pinpoint specific dates, but basically the first from 1820s to 1840s, there is some kind of a no man's land between Enlightenment and modernity.
Final major question I'd like to ask you. This is all obviously interesting for its own sake, but what's the importance of this period in French literature? Why is it worth talking about and reading and discussing here in the 21st century? Why is this enduring and not just a historical relic?
Once again, it's a very difficult question to answer. Why is it important to read 19th century literature? First of all, the problems are usually, I would say, universal. Many of the issues related to personal issues related to relation between man and woman, love, desire, it is still pretty much exists. There are differences, but the bottom line is we more or less function the same way as individual. There's the same way there is a some kind of a universalism. Me, someone from China, from Spain, we are the same human. There's a universalism throughout the period. I am the same person as, and I'm, there are many similarities between people who lived before me and me. So this is why it's important, because there's a dialogue that we can have between generations, between centuries. So this is why it is important. Also because it's an era that was, it's the beginning of our modernity. It's the beginning of democracy, human rights. All this movement, these ideas were put in place during the 19th century. So it's important to understand maybe better our period. It gives us some templates.
I don't think I could have summed up the purpose of this podcast better myself. This has been a fascinating discussion. We'll ask you one final question, and you're on the way out. For listeners who are interested and want to get into French literature of this time, where would you recommend they start? What's a book or author that you'd recommend as a good starting point?
Once again, there are many. If they don't know Les Misérables, they should read Les Misérables. They should read The Red and the Black by Stendhal. A very important book that we just mentioned, but which is very important and one of the best probably novel, in my opinion, published ever, is Madame Bovary by Flaubert. So I would say that these three would be a good start, but I understand that there are many others and people would be mad at me for not mentioning them.
Well, Professor Moisan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
That's the interview. My thanks to all of you for listening to and sharing the podcast, which has continued to grow. Again, if you'd like to learn more about the various figures and works discussed today, visit thesiecla.com/episode16 to read an annotated transcript. And if you're not already following the show, I'd encourage you to subscribe and start listening from episode 1. Over the coming weeks, I'm going to be releasing several bonus episodes of The Siecla, interesting discussions with other history podcasters about the similarities and differences between Restoration France and the places and times they cover. At some point in the next month will come the next full episode, a look at the international scene in post-Napoleonic Europe. Join me then for episode 17, Europe in Concert.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.